Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum, presenting I Saw It, Francisco de Goya, Printmaker. This exhibition features all four of the Spanish artists' major print series in their entirety for the first time on the West Coast. Now on view. More at NortonSimon.org.
Welcome back to Air Talk. We turn our attention to Iraq, where there are still some 5,000 American troops on the ground and some 16,000 American diplomats in Baghdad. And there today, violent protesters attempted to break into the U.S. embassy. They reportedly set fires, hurled rocks, smashed windows, and attempted to force the gate of the compound. Why were the demonstrators protesting? Well, this weekend, Americans launched airstrikes that killed 24 fighters in a militia backed by another regional power, Iran. It all highlights growing fears that Iraq will again become a battleground, this time for a proxy war between the Americans and Iran. We thought we'd check in with an expert on the Middle East and U.S. diplomatic history and try to make some sense of all of this. So we've joined with us Aaron David Miller, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's a former State Department Middle East analyst and a negotiator in Republican and Democratic administrations. Aaron David Miller, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Happy New Year, by the way.
Happy New Year to you as well. So the reason, as I understand it, that these protesters were in the streets were because of these airstrikes against a militia backed by Iran called Kataib Hezbollah. What can you tell me about this group? Why are they important?
Well, they're part of an organized force called the Popular Mobilization Units, or Forces, which were formed in large part under Iranian, with the direct cooperation of the Iraqi government in 2014, to combat the Islamic State. And since the Iranians fell on difficult times in the wake of U.S. sanctions, pay to these units have been decreased. So they've become much more predatory, and they've been acting on their own in a very extractive way against sometimes cooperation with the Iraqi government, and sometimes against it. And you know that there have been mass protests both in Lebanon and Iraq by Iraqi Shia against Iran's influence. But the airstrikes, unfortunately, have now given the Iraqi militias and their Iranian supporters a great propaganda advantage, and they're going to use this against the United States, as I think we suspect that they would in the event that the administration went after, they did in a significant way, five strikes in Iraq and in Syria on Sunday against these units for threatening and actually shelling American forces and causing the death of a contractor. So Trump administration is not on its home court here. We're playing on the field of an adversary. And an adversary enjoys many advantages: geography, demography, history, and the support of local agents on the ground that we do not. So this is increasingly fraught, and I suspect finding a way forward is going to be very tricky.
The adversary you're referring to being Iran?
Yeah, and the administration has made its maximum pressure campaign clear ever since it withdrew from the Iran nuclear agreement, a flawed but also a functional way to constrain, at least for a short term, Iran's nuclear pretensions. And, you know, unfortunately, when the United States, not just this administration, but this administration for sure, factors in its strategy, it never factors in the fact that the adversary has a vote, too. When we act, they react. And again, when you're on their home field, it plays to the disadvantage of the United States as it is right now.
Yeah. So why does Iran care so much about Iraq?
Geography, number one. Number two, as a Shia state, it enjoys both religious and political and security connections with the vast majority of the Iraqi public, which is also Shia. And it's determined to frustrate. Well, we have 5,000 Americans deployed, and thousands of other contractors deployed in Iraq, right on Iran's doorstep. That's also true of Afghanistan, I might add. And the Iranians are interested in maximizing their influence in these countries. Iraq is critically important, far more important than Syria and far more important than Lebanon. And so the Iraqis have a vital interest. They're willing to die. The Iranians have a vital interest, willing to die in defense of Iraq and to mobilize their Iraqi supporters, including the Iraqi government, over whom they have great leverage. And frankly, we are not. We are not that committed. And I suspect if the president had his druthers, he would withdraw from both Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. We'll return to what the U.S. options are here in a minute. But just to, again, kind of get back to what the lay of the land is here. My understanding is that, and you referenced the leverage that this groups like that Iran has over the Iraqi government. And part of it is through groups like the one that we were talking about earlier, Kataib Hezbollah, which has a name that sounds like the Lebanese group that everyone sort of knows from the sort of more the Palestinian side of the conflict. A totally different group here in Iraq, as I understand. My understanding is that that group not only is a militia, but also is a political force and something that has actual, they control seats in parliament, for example. Is that what we're talking about? And are there other militias like this Kataib Hezbollah that are influential in the day-to-day operation of Iraqi government?
Yes, there are. The Badr organization and several others, which have become a valuable source, both to the Iraqi government, of suppressing dissent. Hundreds of Iraqis were killed in these, protests over the last several months, protesting dysfunctional governments, electricity, water shortages, and basically the extractive way in which the government of Iraq pursues its interests at the expense of the Iraqi people. But at the same time, there's growing hostility. As I mentioned before, these paramilitary militias sponsored by the Iranians have become predatory. And as the Iranians have source of income have dried up, they've taken to imposing checkpoints and extortion in order to gain additional resources. So it's a very quirky relationship.
Right.
By and large, the government of Iraq has very little choice in the matter. They're increasingly dependent on Tehran, and they're not going to be able to extricate themselves from the dilemma that they're now in, caught between Iran on one hand and the Iraqi popular militias on the other.
But if I might underline one of the points that I think you were making earlier and that I've read in other places as well, that you talk about Iraq's dependence upon Iranian influence, but Iran is also dependent to an extent, or at least is increasingly dependent, on Iraq as an outlet for economic frustration. Iraq is can be a trading partner for Iran with these sanctions that the U.S. has put into place because of the nuclear deal. Is that right?
100% right, and there's leverage that works both ways. But in terms of their capacity to sacrifice and deny, the Iranians have a clear advantage here. And I think that they will continue to exploit these military strikes, which result in the death of some 25 militia fighters and the wounds of others. I think the administration was caught in a very difficult position here. I think they had to demonstrate that these attacks by the militias weren't acceptable. But at the same time, it's conceivable that they struck too hard. There were scores of others that were wounded, and they've put the Iraqi government, at whose pleasure they are in Iraq, at a kind of grave disadvantage. And you have very influential Shia clerics, Sistani being one, who basically have come out against the presence of foreign actors in Iraq. So politically, while militarily, we have tremendous firepower. Politically, I think we really are at a disadvantage.
All right. Just to sort of talk through what the options are here for the president, he in Syria, in the neighboring country of Syria earlier this year, the president, of course, famously attempted to pull out the skeletal force of troops that Americans had on the ground there. There are reportedly still around 500 U.S. troops in Syria right now, where a lot of the same cross-pressuring geopolitical forces are also at work here. What are the chances that the president looks at Iraq down the road in 2020, sees a lot of the same forces at work here in this similarly complicated situation, and calls a similar play, decides that complete withdrawal is the best option?
Hard to imagine, because remember, we have the Afghan drawdown that is supposed to take place, which will reduce American forces from 12,000 to 13,000 to 8,600. And I suspect, by November, there may be an additional drawdown there, assuming negotiations with the Taliban progress. This is a no-win situation. As much as the president would like to withdraw, he's got to find the right balance here between precipitous withdrawal. And remember, this administration accused its predecessor in 2012 of a precipitous withdrawal, which essentially opened the door for the emergence of ISIS in their telling. On one hand, they've got to maintain some degree of presence and resolve. But on the other, this president is not about to trip into a war with Iran over Iraq or deeply embed American resources in Iraq in an election year. That's all only going to energize his own base against him and to provide his Democratic opponent, whoever he or she may be.
We're going to have to leave that there. Mr. Miller, Aaron David Miller, talking about the situation in Iraq today. Los Angeles has a world-class street food scene. You know it all. Fruits, churros, those bacon-wrapped hot dog things, and elotes, that's the Mexican-style corn on the cob. And up until recently, it was all illegal, against local laws in a lot of communities across Southern California. But that changed a year ago when the state effectively decriminalized street vending. And now Los Angeles is set to unveil a new permitting program to allow the area's estimated 50,000 street vendors sell legally. They can start applying for permits with the city on Thursday. But even though the program's beginning, the regulations aren't set in stone. One city council member has already proposed tightening some of these rules that street vendor advocates already see as strict. First, we have with us to talk about these new rules Los Angeles City Council member John Lee, who represents Council District 12, which is the Northwest San Fernando Valley. Council member Lee, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, we'll get to the division about what these new rules should look like in just a minute. But first, I just want to know from you, why have both the state and cities like L.A. moved to first decriminalize and then legalize street vending?
Well, I just, you know, they want to provide people with a greater economic opportunity. And, you know, I read somewhere that approximately 80% of street vendors are women of color who contribute to the city of L.A.'s economics, and, you know, they wanted to give them a avenue to have a permitting process to, you know, make what they're doing legal.
With me also to discuss these new rules is Rudy Espinoza, who's the executive director of Inclusive Action for the City, a community organization in Los Angeles that has supported legalized street vending from the beginning. Thank you, Mr. Espinoza, for being with us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
What is behind this change, and why have you been pushing for so long for this change to take place?
Well, we've been part of this campaign for 10 years because vendors all over the city have been asking to participate formally in Los Angeles's economy. Many of them have dreams for themselves and for their families, and they have businesses, and they want an opportunity to contribute.
I've read a lot about the concern about, you know, the state legislation being prompted by the Trump administration and the potential that, you know, getting people involved in criminal charges or the criminal justice process because of violations due to street vending, that could put them at risk of something like deportation. Is that a motivating factor here for you, Mr. Espinoza?
Certainly. In 2016, when Trump was elected, one of his first executive orders was to set all folks, undocumented people that get a misdemeanor, to put them on a list for deportation, as a high priority for deportation. Before decriminalization, if you were street vending, you would get a misdemeanor penalty. And so what decriminalization does, it protects these entrepreneurs, that if they are breaking the rules, they will get an administrative citation as opposed to a misdemeanor penalty that will essentially put them at risk for deportation. We don't think that that's just. We believe that street vendors should not be deported if they are trying to take care of their families, you know, with their business.
I want to hear your thoughts, AirTalk listeners, about these new rules that are coming out here. The idea of having a legalized but permitted and regulated street vending process here in L.A. Give us a call and let us know what you think. 866-893-KPCC. Different from the pledge number. I'll say it again. 866-893-5722. You can also go online to the AirTalk page at kpcc.org and leave a comment there or tweet at us at Air Talk. Councilmember Lee, I'm wondering if we can return to you and have you talk us through kind of what are these new rules? What is involved in the new system that that street vendors are going to theoretically have to comply with?
Well, basically, the state passed a law about a year ago, making it legal throughout the state to and left up to the municipalities to have a permitting system, so they could, you know, be like operate as local as legal businesses on our city streets. And you know, I'm all for protecting all the many street vendors who mobilized and petitioned for the city and the state to implement a permitting system so they could operate legally. But unfortunately, what happens every time is that you have some bad actors that make it tough for everyone. And so we're just looking for the state to give different, you know, the city of Los Angeles, the ability to enforce, to have some enforcement authority, because without that, what is the point of the regulations?
Yeah. We can return to your motion in just a second, Councilmember Lee, but I just want to make sure that we can understand kind of what the permitting regulations, what are the obligations that a street vendor are going to have to face under this new permitting system that the city is beginning to roll out. Mr. Espinosa, can you walk us through what are the costs that they have to do, the steps that a street vendor would have to take in order to be fully in compliance with the new law?
Well, it's a really good question, and it's one that is unfolding as we speak. And one of the unfortunate things is that the city of LA has taken a long time to put these rules and these processes in place. I believe just about a week ago, Streets LA, the department that's in charge of this, put the application up on their website to apply for a permit. And so when we saw the resolution from Councilman Lee, we were a bit sort of surprised that before we even implemented the City of LA program, before the City of LA's departments even had anything in place, we were already looking for ways to essentially criminalize street vending again through state channels.
Yeah.
So the process in the City of LA right now is really unclear. I know that the city council did approve a permit fee, one of the most expensive permit fees in the entire country, at $541, though they did offer a discounted rate of $291 for the first 6 months of 2020. We think that, unfortunately, a lot of this is still really unclear, and we hope to get more information from city departments and the city council, hopefully in the next few weeks, because this is coming in place allegedly tomorrow.
Yeah, $291 for folks who apply before July 1 of 2020 to get the permit. And that's just a city permit. In addition, my understanding is that people have to go and apply for a county health permit, which can cost additional dollars, something between $400 and $700 for that, and then pay even more money to find proper storage for the carts that are used to street vend, which can cost thousands of dollars as well. I think, Mr. Espinosa, can you speak to the costs here before we return to the question about how these rules might change going forward and what we might lobby the state to do under Councilman Lee's resolution? Setting that aside for just a second, can people afford these new permitting costs?
I think that, you know, the costs are at least only the City of LA permit fee in and of itself is very expensive. But as you just mentioned, there's other costs that especially food street vendors have to consider. Some vendors will be able to afford them. Some will need assistance from lenders or from other organizations that provide resources to them. And that, I think, is a great opportunity for the City of LA to figure out ways to organize its own resources to support these entrepreneurs. There's an estimated 50,000 street vendors in the City of LA. This is an amazing economic opportunity for our city, and we should be working hard to invite them to participate as opposed to looking for ways to ask the state to give us permission to give the misdemeanor penalties again.
We're talking with Rudy Espinosa, the executive director of Inclusive Action for the City, a community organization in Los Angeles that has been pushing for years for legalizing street vending. We're also speaking with Los Angeles City Council member John Lee, who represents the 12th District, the Northwest San Fernando Valley, about a new system of permitting that is rolling out for street vendors in Los Angeles. For many years, this scene was illegal. It was operating against city ordinance, state law. Recently change that made it so that cities could no longer impose criminal penalties for street vending, and they could apply an administrative fine, like a ticket. Now that has changed in Los Angeles, where Los Angeles has passed a law to legalize and regulate this new system. The question now is how it's going to work moving forward. Councilmember Lee, let me return to you here. When we were talking about when we're talking about what the state allows, the state changed those rules. You want more leeway to be able to impose more than just administrative fines. Can you talk about what it is that you want to be able to do?
Spinoza and I are actually fighting for the same people. We're fighting for the street vendors who mobilized, petitioned the city to implement this permitting system. But unfortunately, there are always people that are going to take advantage of this. We have these pop-up sidewalk restaurants that have large open fires, unsanitary conditions, improper disposal of their waste, of cooking oil, garbage, etc., blocking sidewalks so that we don't have ADA access. Those are the things that we are trying to have the ability to make sure that we have the teeth to be able to go after the people who are violating the rules, who are affecting, who are making it a problem for the people who are actually doing this the right way. Those vendors that fought for so many years, I think Mr. Espinosa said for close to maybe even over 10 years now, been fighting for a legal permitting system so that they could legally do this. And I am fighting for them also. But unfortunately, there are people who are taking advantage of the system and having unsafe conditions. My resolution is about fairness and public health and safety when it comes to street vending, not about criminalizing.
But what is less than criminalizing, but more than an administrative penalty? I mean, I don't know how you. It feels like you're trying to square a circle to an extent. Like you can't impose more than an administrative penalty without getting to criminalizing.
Well, we're just trying to make sure that this health and safety of people in the city of Los Angeles, when you see open fires, when you see, people in restaurants, if they don't have hot water, they're shut down. And it's because of sanitary conditions. We want to make sure
and trying to protect health and safety. I've got to take a quick break there, Councilmember John Lee, but we'll return to discuss the issue of street vending in just a moment on Air Talk. Back on Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, I'm Kyle Stokes sitting in for Larry Mantle today, and we're talking about LA's move to legalize street vending. The state decriminalized street vending with a state law last year, and now there's a new effort by the city of LA to roll out a permitting system for street vendors so that they can sell their food or other wares legally. Councilmember John Lee is one of the people who is joining us, and we were just discussing his hope that while he wants street vending to be able to take place legally in Los Angeles, he also wants the state to amend this law decriminalizing street vending by giving cities a little bit more flexibility to go after offenders, more than one-time offenders. Chronic offenders is the word I might be looking for. We're also joined by Rudy Espinosa from Inclusive Action for the City, which has advocated for a long time for street vending. We heard Councilman Lee's call for more ability for the city to go after offenders. And Mr. Espinosa, I wanted to get your response to that idea.
Of course there's going to be sort of bad actors or offenders in any business sector, but I feel like we're not prioritizing the right thing here. And the priority should be to educate entrepreneurs and give them and open the door for them to get their permit and to invite them into the economy. And that's not what we're doing. That doesn't seem what we're the priority right now is finding ways to enforce and to criminalize. And I think we need to really flip the script here a bit. The issue of bad actors, or they're mostly good, but there's some bad ones, sort of reminds me of sort of some of the Trump rhetoric, that there's some people coming across the border. Some of them are good and some of them are bad. And I don't like that.
Why is it that you feel like we're going, like the idea of going after, that there isn't enough willingness by the city to bring in folks as business people and to educate them, is what you just said? I mean, I think the city, might, come back and say, we've got a bunch of clear rules for the first time now. And a whole system to make sure that vending is safe. Where do you feel that education is not going forward here? Where do you see that problem as being extant?
Well, I think that if you and I went out on the street right now and asked a street vendor, "Hey, do you know how to get your permit that's going to be required tomorrow, January 1st?" Many of them will tell you, "We don't know anything about it." Just a week ago, the Streets LA put their application up online. There hasn't been any serious investment in organizing of city departments to educate the community about this, both street vendors and brick and mortar businesses. And I think that that's where we need to really prioritize, as opposed to looking for ways to criminalize these folks that have worked really hard to participate in the system. And I really appreciate Councilmember Lee's willingness to support street vendors that have organized and worked hard over this last decade to legalize street vending. But if he spoke to them directly, they'll tell him straight up that they do not want misdemeanor penalties, that they want education, they want opportunities, they want access to capital to build their businesses. That's what LA should be about. It should not be about enforcing folks, many folks that are very low income.
Councilmember Lee, I want to give you a chance to to respond here for just a second and say, but I want to flag also that there are other vendors who've talked to our reporters and said that they don't know that these permitting rules are coming forward, despite the fact the city has put these rules out in multiple different languages. So I'd like your response to Mr. Espinosa, but specifically to that point of the fact that there is still a lot of confusion as this is rolling out.
Sure, and like any new law, we rely on a lot of different organizations, like Mr. Espinosa's, organizations like East LA Community Corporation, to help us try to educate, and that in the beginning that there will not be any fines imposed other than, we're going to start giving out warnings to let people know that they have to be a part of this system. There's going to be an education process, and we're hoping, we're looking for, organizations, good organizations like Mr. Espinosa's to help us get that word out about the permitting process. Obviously, it's a new thing, and there's going to be growing pains. And I, believe the city is going to, I know the city is going to understand. We're going to be giving warnings out. We're going to be, understanding that from day one, it doesn't just automatically, magically happen. But I think Mr. Espinosa and I think we're thinking the same things. We all, believe that, street vending should be a part of an inclusive Los Angeles economy. But I think Mr. Espinosa will agree with me. I mean, there are dangerous conditions sometimes when you have large open fires. We've had a fire in our district start from a street vendor because they had large open fire that was unregulated. We've had things about food poisoning because food is not kept in sanitary conditions. We've had complaints about improper disposal of waste, of cooking oil down to the sewer system. I don't think Mr. Espinosa and I are disagreeing on that. Those things we're trying to make sure that those people who are taking advantage of the system, that we're going after them, not from the fruit vendors and the street vendors that have been doing, been fighting for this and trying to be a part of the city's economy. Like, we are absolutely on the same page. I just want to make sure that, we're fighting for, fairness and public health and safety, make sure that we have areas where, a vendor can't just open up right in front of, of a operating restaurant, which we have in different places in our district.
Right. And
fair, and that it's safe.
And in fact, we have someone on the line who's speaking about this concern. Robert is calling in from West Hills. Robert, welcome to Air Talk.
Thank you. I was for 3 years the president of the El Pueblo Commission and am still currently a commissioner. And as a friend of the late Jonathan Gold, I very much appreciate the culinary and cultural contributions of all of our street vendors through the city of Los Angeles. However, El Pueblo is one of the six areas around the city of Los Angeles where street vending is prohibited. The issue has been that we have vendors there anyway that are blocking access for disabled people, selling items in unsanitary conditions, and really pretty much in violation of the law of the signs that are posted throughout the monument that doesn't allow street vending. And it's turned into such a problem that people actually have a hard time getting across the street to El Pueblo because they're so thick with vendors.
We should mention that we've spoken to Streets LA, which is the city agency in charge of implementing this new system. They were not able to join us today. I want to turn to Rudy Espinosa. I mean, is this, who's the longtime advocate for legalizing street vending, does this fall into the issue of education that you've been speaking about here? Or does this speak to the fact that, you know, there are some people who are maybe not willing to comply with rules, even though there are posted signs?
I think it's about education. And I think that maybe Councilmember Lee and I, maybe we do have a lot in common in relation to this, but if I were on the city council, my resolution would be much different. It wouldn't be about asking the state to give us more resources to enforce hardworking, low-income entrepreneurs. It would be a resolution to say, hey, we need more resources to educate entrepreneurs to make sure that they're respecting the public right away and that they have the resources to formalize their businesses. That's what my resolution would look like. And that's not what this resolution is, the one that I'm reading right now in front of me.
I want to thank Rudy Espinosa of Inclusive Action for the City for joining us. I want to thank City Councilmember John Lee for calling in as well, and Robert, the caller from West Hills as well, for calling in on Air Talk today to discuss this very complicated issue of legalizing street vending in Los Angeles, the city rolling out a new permitting process. Already some confusion about what those permitting processes are going to look like, but obviously implementation will follow. It shouldn't come as too big of a shock to you that big companies are tracking you online. We've seen a lot of coverage of this, but the extent to which they are gathering data about you might be shocking to you. One writer found that Google was storing every email he had ever sent, including his deleted emails, as well as the histories of every location he'd been to in the last year. This data is worth big money to the companies who collect it, but on January 1st, a landmark data privacy law takes effect in California that advocates hope will tip the balance of power and maybe let consumers claw back some control of their personal info online. The California Consumer Privacy Act gives consumers the right to request a company share the personal information that it has collected and stored on them with the consumer, as well as giving the consumer the right to forbid the company from selling this personal data. But opponents worry that the law is a knee-jerk reaction and would create compliance challenges for companies. With me to discuss this new law is one of its co-authors. Mary Stone Ross is a former president of the Californians for Consumer Privacy, which sponsored the CCPA. On January 1st, she begins her new role as associate director of the Electronic Privacy Information Center, a Washington, D.C.-based research center. Mary Stone Ross, thank you so much for being with us.
Kyle, thanks for having me.
So what kind of data are businesses collecting on Californians, and what kinds of businesses are collecting that data?
Well, to start, businesses are collecting all types of information about us. They're collecting our health information. They're collecting biometric information. They're tracking our location. And unfortunately, we don't even know right now how much information is being collected, who's doing it, or exactly what is being collected. This, thankfully, will change tomorrow.
So what, you know, I think there's a sense that if you don't want your data out there, don't put it online. I'm wondering to what extent is this, I mean, you know, there are all those terms of service that you click through and a lot of people don't read. I mean, to what extent is this law safeguarding people against choices that they're making to consume these products that are then collecting their data? And then this law is sort of giving them retroactively, you know, the ability to uncheck that box in the terms of service.
Well, quite frankly, right now, it's really not a choice. For example, one company that's selling a lot of personal information is Solve Media, which is they run a service called ReCAPTCHA, which is a little button you click to say, I am not a robot. And so what they're doing is they're connecting stuff like your IP address or your device ID to the fact that you're a human and not a bot. And so that's not a choice. I have to collect that butt just to complete a transaction online.
So what kinds of rights does the law now give to consumers? I mean, we mentioned one of them, which is that you can request the data that a company might have on you. I guess what kinds of rights would, you know, because it's a lot more than that. And what use is it for people to know what kind of data? I mean, if people want to download this data packet, what are they going to learn from looking at it?
Absolutely. So instead of hiding behind a privacy policy that really protects a company, not inform a consumer, now in plain English, a business will have to state what they collect about you, what they collect about your devices, and what they collect about your children. So, for example, there were stories that a flashlight app was, in fact, tracking your location. It would have to disclose that it was tracking your geographic location. And then the second part of the CCPA is it grants all Californians the right to opt out of the sale of that personal information. So if you don't want your location sold, you can tell them to stop.
How are you going to be able to do that?
So you can go to a business, any business in California or outside of California. The nexus is the California consumer, and say, what do you know about me? And after the business verifies your request, they have to return both the categories of information that they've collected about you as well as the specific pieces of information.
Now, Google or Facebook, I believe, offer, and I, you know, there's a list of different companies that a lot of people subscribe to where they offer the ability to download your data and see what sorts of files that they have on you. I mean, theoretically, there are companies that are collecting our personal data that already offer us a look at that personal data. Is there any reason to believe that data is somehow incomplete, or have they been sort of complying with this law all along?
No, I mean, we simply don't know. And then using Facebook as an example, Facebook compiles dossiers on people whether or not you have a Facebook account. So the little Facebook share pixel that we see is in fact a tracking pixel. So I think it'll be really interesting for people that don't have Facebook accounts to go to them and say, what do you know about me? And then see what comes back.
With us also is Eric Goldman, who's a professor of law at Santa Clara University, where he specializes in internet law and privacy issues. Mr. Goldman, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So I get the sense that a lot of opponents feel like this law might be a bit of a blunt instrument. Why do you feel this law isn't the right response to concerns about privacy?
Well, so far in this conversation, we've been talking about electronic data capture by internet companies. But the law covers all facets of the California economy, covers hundreds of thousands of businesses, many of whom aren't likely to be doing anything as interesting as pixel tracking, but all of whom are going to have to spend the money in order to build compliance programs with the very detailed requirements of the law.
And just to label that, I believe that the term of the law is that if you're doing more than $25 million worth of business in selling data, I believe that's what it is, or if you're doing more than half of your business, regardless of the amount, am I getting these details right here, Mr. Goldman, that this sort of sweeps in a lot of different businesses where data is a big part of their business?
No, actually, and it does make a difference. There are three different ways in which businesses might be qualified. One is $25 million in revenue, though that isn't limited to online revenue or data related revenue. It's just $25 million in revenue. That doesn't have to be all in California. Data brokers who get 50% or more of revenues are also governed. That's a pretty small category. And then there's this odd category that basically says any business that collects 50,000 individual personal people's individual personal information in a year are also qualified. And that really picks up a lot of small businesses. In a California estimate, they couldn't even figure out how many small businesses were covered. But the estimate included that maybe up to half of the businesses covered will be small businesses.
That, I mean, to be, you know, you're one of the objections. There's a letter that you posted on your blog that talks about many of the different concerns that you had about the implementation. And you talk about the compliance costs with this new law being one of the issues. I think that if businesses are doing business with your data, compliance costs might rub people as like a bit of a small objection in comparison to the idea that information about their life is being sold. Why is it that we should take a second thought about maybe dismissing that concern when it's our personal information that's being sold?
Well, again, the law applies to all businesses, whether they're selling the data or not. It applies to anyone that meets those three thresholds we described. And again, Google and Facebook are the focus of the law, and they make money. We're not worried about them spending a little bit of money to comply with the law. But when the law reaches, say, Joe's Pizzeria down the street that might meet the thresholds, they're not really transacting in our data, and yet we still are going to have to incur all the same compliance costs. The California state, the regulators did an estimate, or had a consultancy do an estimate, said that 1.8% of the California state gross product was spent on CCPA compliance. So all of us basically spent 2 cents of every dollar last year supporting this law. I query whether or not we got good value for that.
Mary Stone Ross is the co-author of the California Consumer Privacy Act, which takes effect in just a day here. Mary Stone Ross, I'm wondering if you can sort of respond to that idea. I mean, one of the concerns also is around compliance is who's going to be enforcing these provisions of this law? Is there going to be the regulation that in place to make sure that this law is complied with? We've got about a minute left.
Sure. First of all, the law purposefully applies to both online and offline information collection because there is so much information that's being collected on us, even as we walk around brick and mortar stores. And so in order for the law to be truly effective, it needed to cover that information. Secondly, it's the Attorney General who will be the primary enforcer of the CCPA. I'm a little bit nervous that they don't have the resources in place to enforce the law, but we, of course, will see starting tomorrow.
Yeah, as this new California Consumer Privacy Act takes effect, I want to thank our two guests, Mary Stone Ross, the co-author of the new law, the former president of Californians for Consumer Privacy. Ms. Ross, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And Eric Goldman, professor of law at Santa Clara University. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
Discussing the new California Consumer Privacy Act, which takes effect on January 1st. It will give consumers a right to access a whole ream of data from any company that is collecting it or from some companies that meet qualifying conditions that are collecting it. They would also have the option to opt out of this data collection, although if they opted out, the law says that a company could charge them more for the expense of using their service. One of the topics that we are discussing here today on Air Talk. Coming up in just a moment, we're talking about a silver tsunami. We'll explain in just a moment. Back on Air Talk, members of the baby boomer generation, that's folks now over 55 if you're keeping track, own roughly one out of every four homes in Southern California. And demographers think that many of these boomers won't be in their homes for long, maybe because they want to downsize, maybe because they'll move into senior care, or maybe because they'll reach the end of their lives. The result is likely to be a wave of new homes into the housing market. A big wave. Zillow decided to call it the silver tsunami. And the question is what this tsunami of boomer-owned homes into the market will mean for home prices, for Gen Xers or millennials hoping to buy, for California's housing affordability crisis, rather. And joining me to discuss this wave is Dowell Myers, urban planning and demography professor at the Price School of Public Policy at USC. Professor Myers, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me on the show.
You've been writing about this since 2007. Silver Tsunami sounds kind of like a comic book superhero name. Have you ever considered adopting one?
No. I stick to the aging baby boomers.
There you go. So in a report you wrote on this mass exodus on the horizon of boomers from their homes, you described one of the baseline conditions for this trend that I thought was surprising, that there are a lot of baby boomers who own homes and for whatever reason, they aren't leaving. Put that into some perspective for us. How many homes do they own and why have they stayed put so far?
Older people don't like to move very much. They accumulate a lot of possessions and they hang in there. They're going to stay in their homes a long time. still to go, but in the next decade, we begin to have a pretty big sell-off as more and more people decide to retire or they actually die and leave the housing market that way.
And the other thing that you wrote about is that boomers actually aren't downsizing, as you know, you might have read in popular news stories. In fact, they're still buying houses.
Well, I'm a boomer, and I have downsized because I'm a housing professional. But the regular public, they don't. They're holding on to their life, you know, family, how do I say this, a family home where their children grew up, and they just stay there, especially in California. No one leaves here because of bad weather. Whereas in the Midwest, they do leave. They flee the idea of having to keep shoveling snow. But that's not a push in California, so we stay.
So let's talk about what this wave is going to look like. I'll try and use air quotes every time I say silver tsunami. But what is it going to look like? How is this going to flood into the market? Is it going to happen all at once, gradually, geographically? Is there going to be some kind of differential in where these homes are going to be placed? Or is it going to be pretty even across the board? Can you sort of map out where this wave is going to wash ashore?
Well, okay. So, you know, aging is a continuous process. It happens gradually, one year at a time, but it does catch up with you eventually. The oldest boomers are going to be 74 in 2020. That starts tomorrow, I think.
Right.
That's the oldest. The youngest are 56, and so it's a very wide range. It's 18 years was the boom, and so the beginning of it of the oldest group will, you know, be the vanguard, obviously. But they don't. We don't see much change happening until, you know, they get past 80, and then it starts to pick up for the oldest ones. So it'll be most obvious in places where you have an older population already, and you do not have young people. And so that would be places like the Midwest, where they haven't attracted younger workers. Texas, Arizona, Florida, they have a lot of young people, so there's plenty of younger home buyers to soak up any sales. The problem is going to be in the Midwest, and possibly in California. There is a change happening here right now. As we all know, there's been a lot of talk about the out-migration from California and the housing affordability problems that make it hard for young families to get established here. And as we lose our young people, we are losing our future home buyers and our future workers and our future taxpayers. So this crisis of the millennials is something I think that has not been taken seriously by folks.
Yeah, Zillow put out a map describing where boomers are likely to release the most homes into the market. And as you sort of are describing, it's retiree hotbeds that are seeing the highest influx, you know, sort of projected homes that are going to be released in the marketplace, like Palm Springs. And while there are going to be some more homes in coastal communities of Southern California, like Santa Monica or West LA, there won't be quite as many. And that's where the millennials are flocking right now. I'm wondering, to what extent is there a mismatch between where the you know, quote unquote, silver tsunami is going to happen and where millennials want to live, as we're sort of talking about this discussion of where this is going to be the biggest impact?
Boy. Well, the millennials are a very big generation. They're the biggest, and they live everywhere. They're actually out in the suburbs, and they're downtown also. That's their distinction. The thing is, it's not all going to hang on millennials. There's another group that is not discussed about, I don't think, in the Zillow report, and that's immigrants. And in the last decade, immigrants were about 40% of the growth in homeowners. So they're a very big factor that could absorb homes, and they will go wherever. They'll go to the Inland Empire. They'll go to anywhere they can, usually places that are more affordable, not the most expensive, like Santa Barbara or Santa Monica. So that's another factor, too. So but immigrants have been cut off recently. Growth in, you know, has really subsided dramatically since 2000. And so they aren't, it's always possible that we could bring them back. Right now we're chasing them away.
Right.
So, but the millennials are here and they're growing up. And so the oldest millennials now, the peak millennial is going to be, 30, next year, born in 1990. It's the biggest number born in California and born in the U.S. So they'll be 30 and they've been living doubled up in their two bedroom apartments
right
in, you know, Silver Lake or downtown areas or,
And maybe want to find their way into the housing market. Maybe to sort of discuss about what that looks like and how that affects home prices, the interplay not only of immigrant groups that, as we were sort of discussing, millennials or Gen Xers looking to get into the housing market as well. Let's bring in an expert in the California's housing market, Adam Fowler, Director of Research with Beacon Economics. He joins us via Skype. Adam, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kyle.
So I was reading the Wall Street Journal when we're talking about the potential downsides here. Boomer homes will flood the market, quote, on the scale of the housing bubble in the mid-2000s. This time they won't be driven by overbuilding, easy credit, or irrational exuberance, close quote. That's what the Wall Street Journal wrote about this. But now I'm thinking, what if the effect of this is the same? Is there the potential here for some really, really kind of big downsides for the housing market as these homes begin to flood in?
Not that we're seeing. I mean, the national articles, both Zillow and the Wall Street Journal, are talking nationwide. And California is unique in a number of ways. But I think, as Dal mentioned, the Midwest, some of the more retirement communities where older folks have flocked, I think it's a realistic problem where there might be a bit of a mismatch, that glut kind of coming online. I think the real key here is exactly that, where the location is going to be and that price point to meet the future demand. Millennials are the biggest group now in California, but they've not been mirroring their older cohorts in terms of their home buying behavior. They are more racially and ethnically diverse than their older generational cohorts, and they've been held out of the housing market for a little while. There's been a bit of a rebound, but they've delayed a lot of kind of socio-demographic milestones in their lives. So marriage, childbearing, forming their own household. And that is a pent-up demand that is quite large, even compared to the turnover we expect in the gradual passing of older members of the boomer cohort. So here in California, the location of where some of those properties will be coming online will be interesting. It's probably not going to be where our job centers are or are forecasted to be, and really probably not help affordability given the lower construction numbers we've seen at the same time. So the pent-up demand is very real, and it's going to take quite a bit more than just an uptick in baby boomer passing and turnover of their properties.
Yeah, I guess I'm concerned, obviously, as a millennial, I'm looking at this and thinking it's an opportunity maybe for me to break into a really, you know, expensive housing market. On the other hand, if there are so many homes on the market and it becomes a buyer's market to the point where maybe a seller would think, I'm going to hold on to my home and on the thought that I don't want to sell it at a loss or try and avoid doing that, is that a concern that if there are really so many homes that come onto the market, it could really be a problem for the overall health of the market?
Oversupply in California is a long ways off, if ever. We just don't simply see that happening, especially in the areas where we've had a lot of job growth, where younger families are trying to get started. I think, you know, that one of the big problems is, Kyle, you probably trying to save up myself. I'm a millennial as well. It becomes very hard in terms of down payments and costs to actually get into the market. So we've got two things kind of financially going on. Most millennials are renting a lot later, living often in overcrowded or kind of paired up conditions with roommates because the rental prices have been so high. And so that really puts a damper on the amount of money you're able to put back to put forward a down payment and get into the homeowner market. At the same time, folks are incentivized. In California, because of Prop 13, we give every incentive in the world for older folks right. who may actually want to downsize not to. So your family has gone, they've moved on. Maybe the house you raised your family in is too large. You'd like to downsize and open up that property for a new family. We've really, because of the appreciation of the homes, capital gains, and higher property taxes, we've really in California wanted to lock people in, those older generations, into where they live. And I don't think that can be really underestimated
as a factor in California's current housing situation. My thanks to Adam Fowler, the Director of Research with Beacon Economics, an expert in Southern California's housing market. Adam, thank you.
Thank you, Kyle.
And thanks to Dal Myers, a professor of demography at the Price School of Public Policy at USC. discussing the baby boomer generation aging out of their homes, the so-called silver tsunami. We'll be back in just a minute to talk about robot umpires. Back in a moment on Air Talk. Major League Baseball is the sport for purists and history buffs, a sport of tradition and history, the last of the big four American sports to truly embrace the use of video replay. And now it could soon have robot umpires. All right, that's a bit of an overstatement. But the Baseball Umpires Union has recently agreed to allow the league to begin testing an automated system for calling balls and strikes. Again, just testing, but some minor leagues have already started using so-called robot umpires. The labor agreement here in the majors appears to set the stage for further expansion of the system's use, at least in the minors, which has to get you wondering how close we are to having automated ball and strike calls in major league games. And with me to discuss the development is J.P. Hornstra, the MLB reporter for Southern California News Group. He tweets at J.P. Hornstra. J.P., welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so is this like Rosie the Robot behind the plate? Explain to listeners who may not be familiar how this system would work.
Yeah, not exactly like Rosie, but the idea...
So there's no like animated like tin can behind the plate doing this?
Not yet. Not yet. We can dream, right? The idea is that there is a computer that will be tracking every pitch as it is thrown and detecting whether that ball, that pitched ball, lands somewhere within the defined strike zone on its way to home plate. And, you know, therein sort of lies the details. How do you define the strike zone? How do you calibrate the system? How do you deliver that ball strike call to the umpire? Because there's still going to be a human being standing behind home plate, to our knowledge, and he still has to make the call. But the actual determination of a ball or strike will be made by an electronic tracking system. Automated ball strikes, ABS, that's what they like to call it in the business.
Got it. This was deployed apparently in the Atlantic League during sporadic, I think it was in like the All-Star game was called with it. There were some other games that were called with this in the Arizona Fall League, which is for the prospects. And there was an iPhone and an earpiece, I mean, which seems kind of low tech for such a big money sport. But that's how the system works apparently.
Right. And therein... We created some interesting variables. Like in the Atlantic League, they were saying depending on the weather could affect what was called a ball and a strike. One of the other sort of low-tech quirks about this is that if you had listed your height incorrectly as a batter, you could get the incorrect strike zone. If you had exaggerated your height by an inch, for example, it would call your strike zone somewhere outside of the defined height, which is just below the knees to just above the belt. So players were scrambling to get their heights listed accurately. And even there in the two leagues that you mentioned, the Atlantic League, which is an independent minor league, it had to sign a sort of special agreement with Major League Baseball, and the Arizona Fall League, which is affiliated with Major League Baseball. Even then, the pitch tracking system was slightly different. So we're still in the very early stages of experimentation.
Yeah. What kind of development is necessary that we're talking about in developing this system at the major league level? I mean, what is this test going to look like?
It's a good question. Part of the tentative agreement reached between the umpires and the league involved potential testing in the minor leagues in 2020. And if not 2020, you have to figure that's going to come around in 2021. But you have to standardize all of these things for the ballpark. You have to make sure that weather isn't an issue. You have to make sure all the players are listing their heights correctly. You have to make sure nobody can hack into the system and start feeding the umpire incorrect ball and strikes information.
That'd be a very high-tech Black Sox scandal, if you will.
Seriously, that would be an interesting one. But all of these things are things that need to be ironed out. And really, the substance of the agreement isn't that we're going to have this within the next 5 years, but rather that the umpires have agreed to let Major League Baseball do some of these tests, figure out what some of the variables are that can be encountered from ballpark to ballpark over the next 5 years.
Rob, on the AirTalk page right now, writes, about time. Nothing frustrates me as a fan seeing a strike zone so out of proportion that it makes the game about the umpiring and not about the players. Welcome to the 21st century, MLB. You can share your thoughts as well on the AirTalk page at kpcc.org. And J.P. Hornstra, there have been some pretty like bonkers ball strike calls over the year. I'm looking at you, Joe West. But our parents, that's the name of an umpire for those of you who are players generally happy though with the state of umpiring? Or, I mean, cause that's, players are a famously change averse group in the major leagues right now. They have their routines and you know, maybe is the devil they know worse than the devil they don't? Like, what do they want?
I would say that players are a little bit more like fans when it comes to umpiring than you might expect.
Really?
They see what you see. They get mad when you get mad. Obviously, they're biased if it goes against their team. They're upset. If a bad call goes for their team, you won't hear them complain. All of these things are things that I've heard inside of locker rooms. The few players who I have heard really vociferously say they don't want this are the older players, guys who really grew up. Maybe in the 80s or the 90s, and they've been around longer, and maybe they're not as accustomed to change as some of the younger players. I mean, there are minor leaguers who are going to have this system foisted on them at some point in the next couple years, and it's just going to be part of their normal existence as a professional baseball player, is the automated ball and strike. But if you've been playing, again, if you've been playing in this game professionally for 20 years, and all you know is the human element, you've had a long time to get adjusted to it, and any change to that, I think, is going to rub you the wrong way, much like, I would say, probably older fans are probably the most resistant to it as well.
Right. I'm curious, though, you know, there we talk about the human element in umpiring, but there's been technological influences for a long time. I looked up Questech at, you know, in prepping for this interview, and sure, I thought it was just within the last couple of years. That was 2001 that the MLB first rolled out a system for evaluating umpires' ball and strike calls. You know, Arizona Diamondbacks pitcher Curt Schilling smashed one of the cameras with a with a baseball bat because he didn't like it as well. But umpires were being told, you know, how accurate their calls were. Technology has been influencing these calls. JP, I'm wondering if the influence of technology is already kind of baked in to the ball and strike calls that we're seeing made on the field, or like whether the human element is diminished somewhat.
I think it is, and I think that's a very keen observation, where once you had technology at least reached the point to where it could be an independent third party, independent of the umpires, independent of the teams, offering some kind of feedback, it was really a question of, well, could that technology supersede the accuracy of the umpire? And we're finally starting to reach the point where, yes, maybe it can. Mm. But even within the last 20 years, even since Questech, you've seen pitchers get a lot less leeway, whereas I think 20 years ago, it was very common to see pitchers try to game the system in their favor, where maybe they get half an inch off of the outside corner on one pitch, and then they try to go another quarter inch off of the outside corner, and then another quarter inch, and then pretty soon by the end of that game, that pitcher has an extra inch on that outside corner as opposed to his opponent. Well, umpires are more sensitive to that now. They know they're going to get graded after the game, and absolutely, you've seen the strike zone become more uniform, I think, for the better. You know, even that pitcher who I said has been pitching professionally for 20 years, that hypothetical pitcher, he has seen the strike zone become more accurate during his lifespan as a professional baseball player. So even he can't say the technology hasn't encroached on the strike zone somewhat.
But I was reading, on there was an analysis of the most accurate umpires, and Major League Baseball doesn't use the accuracy calls to determine like which umpires are calling the World Series. The World Series is not the all-star game of umpiring. And sometimes the least accurate umpires, Joe West, are being asked to umpire the World Series games.
Right. And I think that harks back to the fact that this is a it is ultimately a collectively bargained process by which we can even get to the point where it is a computer who is calling the balls and strikes. Part of the traditional agreement between the umpires and Major League Baseball is that the more experience you have, the higher your chances of calling a postseason game.
Hmm.
And sometimes, yes, that does come at the expense of accuracy, much to fans' chagrin. But I think, like I said, we're not going to see Rosie the Robot or any other kind of automated ball strike system behind home plate until the umpires sign off.
We'll have to wait for Westworld to become true, to have an actual robot behind the plate calling balls and strikes. My thanks to J.P. Hornstra of the Southern California News Group to discuss robot umpires potentially in Major League Baseball here this morning on Air Talk.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism.
one lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.